fact, our next panelists, both of her and Mitzi, are youth activists who came from youth movements that really brought a new energy and really reimagined the politics of intersectionality that builds on the work of so many of our movements have done. I'm really pleased that we have Michaela Loach, who's a great organizer, who writes, focuses on these intersections of the climate crisis and how they intertwine with oppressive systems, and also about how we make our climate movement a much more accessible space. I'm sure you've picked up her book. She's like an amazing author of the Not That Radical, The Climate Action to Transform Our World, but also comes with was a former medical student and has got a degree in global health policy. So often I think in our struggles, we know we have many fights to fight. We don't celebrate the victories that we do have. And it was great back in 2021, the Stop Cambo oil field campaign, which Michaela was part of, that very successful campaign. And also was one of the three claimants on the Paid to Pollute case, which took the UK government to court over the huge amounts of public subsidies that were being handed over to fossil fuel campaigners every year. Really pleased Michaela is here with us. I know she's not been well, and she's just literally just agreed to pop on to contribute. So thank you again, Michaela, for making the time. And now over to you.
No, thank you so much for having me. Yes, sorry, everyone. I am not going to be on top form, but I'm really grateful to be here. And thank you all, everyone, for being here. Just in a fair bit of pain, but it's all right. We're gonna get through this. Not get through it, we're going to enjoy it, because it's important. And this is a very, very important topic. So thank you all so much for taking your time out on a Thursday evening to come and listen to all these incredible speakers who I feel incredibly humbled to be put along with in this. And I'm going to be talking a bit about climate justice, and I thought I would start with how I got into this movement, because for me getting into the climate movement was actually through a lens of migrant justice. So I was born in Jamaica, a small island in the Caribbean that, despite our like very small size, has had a very big impact on the world, and so people do actually know where it is, and moved to the UK when I was about 3 years old. And growing up in the UK, as a Black woman, as a Black person in the UK, I experienced obviously a lot of racism in lots of different ways, a lot of interpersonal racism in particular, and structural more as I got older. But I could see that this world is not the best as it could be. And then I remember very clearly the moment that I kind of got radicalized, I guess, was a moment that many people will probably remember, a really harrowing moment. So just, I guess, a true warning for I'm going to be talking a bit about Alan Kurdi and the photograph of a 3-year-old Syrian boy's body washed up on a beach in Greece. And I remember seeing that photo and thinking about the fact that when I was around the same age, I was able to move to the UK safely and easily and legally just because of the privilege of having a British father and a white British father in particular. And that same privilege and luck of birth and of position was not offered or not allowed for Alan or his family. And I just really could not let go of that feeling that if it had been a different island that I was born on, if it had been a different circumstance I was born into, it could have been me and my family in that situation. And the unfairness of it really hit me whilst I was a teenager. And so I got involved with migrant justice organising in Calais in particular, just doing very material things of chopping wood and baking things and cooking food for people. And that really first showed me that to be an activist or to do activism is just to be active in the face of an issue that you see. But also that really illuminated to me how much the kind of legacy of and the persistent legacy of colonialism is the reason why so many people are displaced in the first place, and therefore that there's a huge responsibility that we have as people who live in the core of the empire to have an impact on that, not only the policies on our border, but also the policies that have put people in those situations in the first place and addressing that harm. And so I wasn't really into climate at that point, because I think like many people who are racialized racialized as Black in particular, I felt like there were more pressing issues, in particular that migrant justice is a more pressing issue than the climate crisis. And I still at that point saw them as quite separate, that police brutality is a more pressing issue, that that poverty is a more pressing issue for my community in particular. And I felt like the climate crisis was just for, like, to be honest, middle-class white people who had nothing better to worry about. And it was only actually when I was in Cali and having conversations with people who were displaced, and realizing how many of their situations not just was because of colonialism, but also because of the climate crisis, and realizing that the climate crisis is just going to make insecurity for people globally even worse, and realizing about climate justice in particular, its legacy of colonialism, that it's not the great equalizer that we're told it is, it's actually the great multiplier, as Mitzi spoke on so brilliantly, and that it multiplies the existing ways people are oppressed, that I became passionate about the climate crisis and tackling it, and realized that it is a very pressing and important issue today and for communities today as well, as, and it's not just this kind of existential threat of the future. And also I went back to Jamaica to see my family, and a beach that I grew up going to, Helsha Beach. I don't know if anyone's, there's always Jamaicans in any event I've ever done, because we are everywhere. But people will probably know about Helsha Beach. And I kind of grew up going to that beach very frequently. And then going back to Jamaica, and visiting my grandmother and going back to that beach, I saw that it's almost completely disappeared. And I actually moved back to Jamaica last year and spent a bit of time in Helsha. And my grandmother lives about 10 minutes drive from that beach. So many communities live in that area, much more proximal. And if that beach is already disappeared now, if when I drove around the island in Jamaica, you can see the water levels of where flooding has hit, especially on the coastal communities. Those impacts are already happening now. What's it going to be like in 10 or 20 years if we don't take adequate action? An important thing, if we don't take adequate action, because action is happening, but in the wrong way, often on climate. So yeah, climate justice is the great equalizer. It's not the great equalizer, it's the great multiplier. So for example, humans in poorer countries are around 5 times more likely than those in richer countries to be displaced by sudden extreme weather disasters. And even in that, we need to interrogate why are countries poor or rich in the first place? Like, what do we mean by those markers? And Michael Parenti says that countries are not poor, they are overexploited. And then I would say that countries in that sense are not rich, they overexploit. And so there's a relationship there. So it's not just because of geography that certain countries are made more vulnerable. It's also because of these historical relationships between the global north and global south. So whilst we might be in the same storm, we are not in the same boat. Some of us are in like giant ocean liners that have been funded by colonial wealth, and then others have been forced into unseaworthy rafts who've had their resources stripped away from them in order to build these huge colonial liners that that protect others. And that relationship is really important for us to understand in both the creation of the climate crisis and the impacts that are being felt today. So climate justice demands that we interrogate the foundations of this world that created the climate crisis in the first place, these foundations of whiteness, which is a power system. It's not just that we talk about environmental racism, which I'll talk about a bit later. I think people sometimes think that very kind that people are saying nice things in the chat. I'm going to try and focus though. But I think sometimes people think that when we talk about these power systems, that it's, oh, well, you know, the climate doesn't care about what someone looks like or what their features are or their heritage. But it's not that pollution is following people because it doesn't like them. It's because it's about power systems and that prioritize some lives and deprioritize others, and therefore put some lives in deliberately into precarity and vulnerability and protect other lives. And so, for example, I've talked about the global north and global south a little bit, and I would love to touch on that more, but I'm going to use some UK examples. Even within the UK, so there's obviously the different impacts of where countries are geographically in global north and global south, but even within countries like the UK and the global north, how people are like positioned in our hierarchies under whiteness and capitalism, people experience oppression differently, and therefore they are impacted by the climate crisis differently. So for example, Black communities in the UK are particularly more likely to be situated next to incinerators and next to dangerously high levels of air pollution. For example, the example that I use in my book is about Edmonton, because the Jamaican side of my family who came over to the UK, so my grandma stayed in Jamaica, but her brothers that came to the UK in the 70s, They moved to an area called Edmonton that a lot of people obviously know in London. And in that area in London, it has 65% of the population are people of colour. It's also one of the most deprived areas of the UK. And it also is the site of the largest waste incinerator in the UK, the Edmonton Eco Park Incinerator. And it's not just Edmonton where incinerators that cause dangerous levels of air pollution are situated. This trend is seen across the UK. And it's also, again, it's not just in this situation, it's not just race, it's also about class and also about what communities are seen as or situated as more disposable and allowed for these kind of harmful infrastructure to be put next to them. So it's in the global north as well as globally. But that might all seem really serious and scary and sad. And I think I'll talk a bit about fear in a moment. But what got me into the climate movement and didn't take me away from the migrant justice movement, but more like incorporated climate into the work that I was already doing to try and tackle systems of oppression. It wasn't just the fear. It wasn't just the amplification of oppression. It wasn't just the amplification of inequality. It was this realization that as the climate crisis has come from these same systems that have caused harms to different people over and currently materially and also historically, then to tackle it adequately, we also have to tackle these same systems. And therefore, in that way, climate justice gets to be a portal into a better world, a portal into a new world, an opportunity to transform everything, an opportunity to really tackle these issues finally. So by tackling these root causes of whiteness, capitalism, colonialism, we can create a more equitable and transformed world for all of us. And we have to remember that the elite class don't want us to do this. They want to distract us and divide us. They want us to demonize people who have the same interests as us in creating this better world. They want us to focus on those who are already marginalized rather than realizing that it's those who have a huge amount of power that have caused this crisis. And they're scared of our power when we come together. They're scared of us recognizing these connections that we have between migrant justice and climate justice in particular. And we always have to ask when we're seeing communities being demonized in the news or anywhere, or even within our groups, when we hear people say that to talk about issues of justice is diluting the movement or diluting the message, we have to ask that, who does this serve? Who does that narrative? That these issues are too much or too distracting or too complicated, like, who is benefiting from that narrative? And I think that who's benefiting from that is the elite class. And I'd ask you at any moment, always ask, like, who does this serve? And we have to also remember that all climate action is not climate justice. It is very possible for us to take climate action that makes a more unequal world. So that would be called ecofascism in particular. So it's very possible for us to take climate action that increases austerity, that causes more harm to people who are already experiencing a huge amount of oppression, already being forced to live with less. That is very possible. And also it's important to recognize that climate action is going to happen at some point. And so what the climate movement's role needs to be is not only when that happens, but how it happens and what world are we going to be creating? What is that world that comes next going to look like? Are we going to go down the route of ecofascism in which people have caused more harm? Or are we going to take this portal into a new world in which all of us get to live in dignity, all of us get to be safe, and we actually can address these inequalities and these oppressions? And I think that climate justice requires us to come together and demand more, knowing that not only we can create this better world and this transformed world, but that we must, because the alternative of ecofascism is so deeply terrible that we have to turn away from it. And we also have to realize that to incorporate the reality of this world, to realize that there is no single issue struggle because we don't live single issue lives, as the great Audre Lorde said, is not to make our movements weaker, but to make them stronger. It is for us to actually be finally tackling the real roots of this crisis, rather than just putting a band-aid on an issue whilst the rot is still there. We need to treat that kind of internal rot in the same way as, I was a former medical student. When someone came in and had heart pain or chest pain, not heart pain, they wouldn't say heart pain, they had chest pain, and I gave them a painkiller, but didn't treat any of that heart disease that's causing that in the first place, they're going to keep coming in with more manifestations of that disease. That same thing can happen with our world. If we take climate action that just addresses emissions, it's like giving a a painkiller to someone with heart disease. What we need to actually do is treat the disease in our world, which is whiteness and capitalism and imperialism and colonialism. And to do that makes our movement stronger, not weaker. And to do that creates a world where all of us are safe and live in dignity. And I think to do that is also to create a movement that is exciting for people to join. And also to do that does not have to, we need to, our role as well is to communicate that as not being outrageous or ridiculous or too radical, as some people would frame it, but as the common sense that it is, the common sense that all of us want to be safe, the common sense that this crisis did come from these issues, and therefore to tackle it adequately, we have to tackle these issues too.